The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
There you go. And really, who among us hasn't? Good morning. Happy Friday. Let's just get kicking. This isn't, to me, just a discussion about fascinating and explosive events some 50 years ago in France, though it's that, I hope. The dramatic street battles between police and the students that escalated into the largest general strike up to that time, some 10 million French workers in May and June of 1968, exposed, I think, the limits of spontaneity and political eclecticism. I think that for decades, radicals in this country have kind of exoticized the late 1960s and early 1970s, unless I'm projecting, maybe that's just me, because social unrest on a mass scale that actually wins something and has a vision for a different world just has seemed for so many decades unimaginable and of a otherworldly. And now when we're living through an era of tumult where mass explosions seem once again believable, imaginable in our lifetimes, it feels like conversations like this become more urgent. Because what we do in these moments are things we have to start thinking about and talking about now. 50 years ago in France, an authoritarian regime presided over a crumbling empire after 22 years of wars and occupations. France, remember, or don't remember, if you never knew, we'll give you a potted history of France right here. From 40 to 45, 1940 to 45, was under Nazi occupation, which actually catapulted a fellow by the name of General de Gaulle into global prominence. He was actually still president in 1968 at that point for 10 years. French war in Vietnam had taken place from 1946 until 1954, when the Vietnamese successfully booted the French out, only for the Americans to come in and have it be their turn to get their asses kicked. Following that, the French tried desperately to hang on to their last colony in Africa, in North Africa, in Algeria, from 1954 to 1962, in which a brutal guerrilla war was fought by the Algerians to kick the French out successfully by 62. So that's the sort of mise en scène of what was happening and developing in 68. 50 years ago in France, right, you have an authoritarian regime under General de Gaulle, presiding over a crumbling empire that had had more than 20 years of occupations and wars, and had the lowest paid working class in Western Europe, who worked the longest hours, paid the highest taxes, and had an unprecedented number of college-educated 20-somethings with no visible job prospects. And the situation was quite bleak. All of that sounds very familiar, actually, doesn't it? In that year, and even in those months, that whole year, of course, is a turning point year when revolution, or at least radical transformation of society, was on the agenda for millions of people around the world. And it was the first time in modern history when the ruling class of a Western industrial power lost control of its own country, even if for only a few days. Today, France 68 is not just a beacon of hope for the transformative power of workers' ability to shut down society in an advanced industrial nation. I think it's also a cautionary tale about the implications of organizational conservatism on the one hand and radical opportunism on the other. It forces us to think of how a revolutionary left faced with an uprising could have ended things differently. And it forces us to consider how we might operate under similar circumstances in the coming years. The first question to ask, of course, we've given a somewhat provocative titles, right? Prelude to Revolution. Was France 68 a revolutionary or near-revolutionary situation? Well, we can say that for several weeks in May and June of that year, right in the heart of affluent Europe, right? We're not talking about the stomping grounds of the colonial stomping grounds of Africa and Latin America and Asia, but in Western Europe, a student rebellion spread to millions of industrial and service workers, raising the question of power. Revolution, which is to say the overthrow of one class by another, was certainly never on the agenda, not on the immediate agenda, but most of the ingredients that would go into a pre-revolutionary crisis would nonetheless be present in France in 1968. The Russian revolutionary Lenin describes a revolutionary situation as one in which the ruling class cannot go on in the same old way and the working classes won't let them. This kind of tidy formula does apply in some fashion to France 68, but it does not follow that the working class had a vision of itself taking power. And frankly, no mass organized political force with roots inside the class posed toppling the regime in anything other than electoral terms as an option. The Marxist historian Daniel Singer, who wrote that, it's a wonderful book, Prelude to Revolution, France in May 68, sums up France 68 this way. He says, no revolution, but many of the symptoms of one. What stopped this prelude to revolution from developing further? How was it that just weeks after millions of workers had shut down an entire country, students in the hundreds of thousands taking to the streets in solidarity with them, how is it possible that just weeks after that, the right wing is able to reconsolidate itself electorally? That, I think, we are going to talk a lot about this morning. I would say among the reasons, the key reasons why, number one, the largest left party, the French Communist Party, which still had a reputation for its role as the leadership of the resistance during World War II against fascism, right, while France was occupied, loomed large in people's minds. It was a party with some 300,000 or so members in the late 1960s. 5 million voters would vote for them, representing somewhere near a quarter of the French electorate. And of course, it had the support of the largest trade union federation, the CGT. And yet the Communist Party blunted and then buried the general strike, and we're going to talk more about that. That would be number one. Number two, the revolutionary left organizations, in particular the JCR, the Young Revolutionary Communists, whose membership numbered in the hundreds, were simply too small and not implanted enough inside of the working class. And so despite many of their analyses that were accurate and their heroic efforts, they were insufficient to the task. And finally, I would say, is the third dominant reason, that the capacity of social democratic parties to co-opt and derail mass struggle can never be underestimated. And we'll get into that much more as the story unfolds as well. So the 68 generation that was radicalizing around the world witnessed in France the unique power of the working class. Right? Millions across the world were wrung to a Marxist conception of workers' power after May 68. Unlike the powerful student protests that had dominated the early 60s, when we think in this country of Berkeley 1963, the free speech movement, which certainly gave a vision of a different kind of a society and a beautiful, enormous movement, but nonetheless was made up of students who did not have the capacity, did not have the leverage, who did not have the social weight that workers have to shut things down. And yet, in France, the general strike by 10 million workers, one third of whom actually were unionized, right? Interesting for us to think about, was not only able to put a wrench into the machinery of the system, but actually shut it down and raise questions about how society might be organized differently. And in doing so, I'd say French June 68 not only altered French society, but altered the imaginations of most of the global left. After France 68, the notion that Western workers were bought off and would never fight, were complacent, and all the rest of that, were certainly muted, although we can see how those those histories, those stories can re-rise again. The words of left historians like Andre Gorz, who had pretty much written off the working class, certainly the Western working class as a force for change, were, you know, pushed to the sidelines. The C. Wright Mills, the Herbert Marcuses, who were arguing that it was the role of intellectuals and students to change the world, no longer workers. All of that was pushed aside in the minds of many millions of people who were being revolutionized. Class struggle was on the agenda, and not just in the global South, but smack in the center of global capitalism. So what happened? I think because it makes for clever headlines, the story that it all began with men, male students wanting to visit female students' dorms, makes for a sexy explanation of a general strike. And did happen. That was true. It did happen the year before in 67. And it did lead to major, and was an expression of major shifts taking place, certainly in higher education. I would say that it was one of nearly many, many sparks that lit the fuse. And a key one was the vast expansion of higher education from some 200,000 students around 1960 to 500,000 students by 1968, which is not only meant crowded classrooms and, you know, resources that were just simply slapped together and all the rest of that, mostly concentrated, interestingly enough, around Paris, but also the extension of a college education for the first time in France to working class students. It was no longer simply the exclusive preserve of the children of the wealthy and the upper middle classes. That was a very new component in France in the late 60s. And this shift in higher education reflected then, just as the neoliberalization of higher ed today does, it indicated a structural shift in French capitalism to confront its altered relationships with the former colonies and the rapid industrialization in a country that had been 40-something percent agricultural just prior to World War II. And it was in a period of extraordinary high youth unemployment, as high as 30% in some parts of the country. Socially, Marxists of our political tradition had historically sort of used to think of students as in a kind of suspended state of being. They were sort of no longer simply some boss's or some worker's kid, who were also not yet prisoners of their job or class position that they were heading into. They were somehow a sort of declassed layer in society in that sense, and especially in an era when education was free. In addition to being, of course, young and not having had the experience of decades of being told you cannot do that and running into walls from the bosses, from the establishment, from political parties and all the rest of that, fed a certain militancy and all the rest of that. I no longer think that we can define students in the world today as sort of a D-class layer when they are most certainly not simply the children of workers. They are themselves working more often than not full-time along with trying to get an education. Most students in U.S. today are not, you know, working class because of their parents are. They're working class because they are workers. On March 22nd of 68, students at the Nanterre campus outside in the western suburbs of Paris began protesting the Vietnam War with the U.S., and they were brutalized by the police. 142 of them wound up occupying the campus, and one of its leaders, along with others, Daniel Combandi, were arrested, only leading to an escalation of those protests. Danny the Red, as he came to be known, became a sort of global face of the May phase, certainly the student phase of the rebellion, and in fact became such a sort of touchstone of both ire and idolatry that in the very height of the May events, the far right, when they took the streets in the numbers of nearly a million at the very end of the month, their chant was, Combandi à Dachau, send this German Jew to Dachau, to the concentration camps. And the response, the retort of hundreds of thousands of workers and students was, we are all German Jews. You think about the symbolism of that just 20-something years after the Holocaust, as the facts of the Holocaust were only just being revealed. And it gives you a sense of the tensions and the polarization inside of French society at that time. The March 22nd movement, which came out of that, was one of the dominant far-left groupings that came out of this period. And like many of the left formations of the time, they eschewed elected leaders and accountable structures and were often hostile to what Marxists like myself see as crucial role of party building. After June, in fact, I think many of them ceased to, as a group, exist, but played a dynamic and important role inside of the debates and inside of the struggles that in those months. By early May, the student protests escalated rapidly. By May 4th, around the time when I was learning to tie my shoe, that was my third birthday, students at the Sorbonne campus in the Latin Quarter, which is sort of like the bohemian student district of Paris, found themselves locked out of their campus. Which was occupied by the police. And these weren't just sort of regular police. In France, you have a sort of paramilitary or crypto-fascist, I think is the way Jonah describes it in his Jacobin piece, which I think is accurate, which grows out of the period of occupation by the Nazis. They had been the enforcers of the Vichy regime that collaborated with the Nazis and brutally repressed fascists and immigrants and the left, of course. The CRS by 1968 numbered 14,000, and they remain today a really terrifying armed force. During the Algerian War in 1961, in fact, when there was, you're talking about towards the end of the occupation of France, of Algeria by France in the midst of this brutal war, if you've never seen Battle of Algiers, see it, watch it, you will learn an enormous amount. It's a wrenching film. You will understand why. They basically mowed down, the CRS simply mowed down in a protest of hundreds of thousands of Algerians and other North Africans primarily. These, of course, are people from the former colonies of France marching peacefully in the streets of Paris, were simply shot down by the hundreds. In fact, I don't even think France acknowledged the massacre until some 20 years ago or so, and even then they say some dozens were killed. It was clearly hundreds of people. So it is no curiosity why the chant on the streets of Paris and frankly in every city against the CRS, this is a nationwide rebellion, was CRS SS. Right, CRS SS. They are the Gestapo of French society. May 10th, 11th, just 1 week later, was the night of the barricades. On that night, a massive student protest led by the Union of French Students aimed to reoccupy the French Quarter and take back their campuses. They were confronted by the CRS literally in the middle of the night at 2 o'clock in the morning, began to brutally beat them. In fact, it came out later on that it was government ministers that even signed onto an order telling them to be merciless and to beat the student protesters. The students fought back heroically, many of them digging up the streets made of cobblestones. As my French comrades described to me when I lived there some years later, they said they were small enough to fit in your hand, big enough to hurt really bad. And so people would dig up the cobblestones. That's where the sort of situationist, the anarchist expression of beneath the streets, the beach, you know, because it'd be sand underneath the cobblestones. That night, thousands of people poured out of their homes to join the students in the streets throughout the Latin Quarter. They built hundreds of barricades. You know, if you've ever been to Paris, you know the streets are these little serpentine little, you know, beautiful. And so they set up hundreds of barricades. And these were people coming out of their homes to join the students, seeing the mayhem going on the streets, and just instinctively siding with the students against the brutality of the police. And when I lived in Paris 20 years after 68, when I was just out of college, and my friends would tell, you know, their own stories of heroism of what they had done in 68, and we'd always sit in the cafe by the Sorbonne where you still had the markings of how the CRS that night had literally gone into the cafes and smashed them up, and you can see the table markings where they used them as barricades against the police. Everybody had their stories of this at that time, whether they thought of themselves as quote-unquote political or not. They knew which side they were on when a fight was on. 100s were wounded and hospitalized that night, including 250 cops. We got ours in. Hundreds more were arrested, and foreigners like Conbandi were soon deported. People were shocked. People were shocked by the viciousness that was meted out by the CRS against basically their kids. Even workers who still saw college students as rich kids, as the pampered children of the rich, held those students in really high regard for the heroism that they'd shown on the sort of battlefield, if you will, of the Latin Quarter, and certainly took note. Whereas the heads of the largest left organization, the French Communist Party, this party of 300,000, this party with a daily newspaper, L'Humanité, they had basically dismissed the students as daddy's little children who were going to run off to run the factories, you know, once their little skirmishes in the streets were done. This was bullshit. This was nothing. Pay no attention. Well, that was on Friday. By Monday, a one-day general strike had been called. They were forced by their own members. When the Prime Minister, Pompidou, returned from abroad the next day, he was compelled to order the police to retreat. He basically thought, either the students are going to take it back, or we let them have it back. He wanted to de-escalate the situation, but too late. In fact, seeing that this brutish state, this authoritarian state, could be brought to heel in that way if anything gave workers confidence. Workers who had been having small localized skirmishes and strikes over the previous year, but nothing generalized at all. And that watching the students battle and their ferocity and their bravery and seeing the government back down, this combination was powerful, was potent, and it changed people's minds. You know, there's a... What began as a one-day strike took off after that across the country. In effect, the baton was kind of passed from the students to the workers, and the center of the struggle had shifted. The Marxist Ian Burchill puts it this way. He said, in some phases of the class struggle, confidence is more important than consciousness, and this was definitely one of those moments. Much of the extraordinary street art of that era and the graffiti and the radical slogans like be practical, demand the impossible, or the boss needs us, we don't need the boss, all of these kind of beautiful, the nous sommes le pouvoir, the you're wearing it. Nope, somebody was. It's all some cover that I knew I'd see it. The workers standing together and students. This all comes out of these days, these weeks. I want to now talk a little bit about the general strike itself. It was the next day, Tuesday, right? It had been planned as a one-day strike. People go back to work the next day. Not everybody wanted to go back to work. The workers at Sud Aviation, the 780 aviation workers, they were the first to act. They had been having these sort of 15-minute strikes on Tuesdays for months. Not this time. People went out for 15 minutes, they never went back. In fact, they not only never went back, but 2,000 of them occupied the factory, and hell, if you're gonna occupy the factory, take the bosses. So they took 20 of the executives and held them captive for 2 weeks. And there's actually a funny story about it because they were very democratic about it. They actually met every night to vote to decide whether or not they were going to keep holding them captive. They fed them, they gave them water, they had access to the lavatory. Although it was they actually initially would blast the Internationale into the room all day and all night long. which drove the workers who were guarding them crazy. So after 2 days, they stopped doing it. But boss napping has a rich history in France, and I think we need to learn that history. The factories that hadn't taken action on the Monday began to get jealous. They were like, wait a minute, these guys went out. Why didn't we go out? Auto, aerospace, metal, shipyards, the first to go out one after the other were those workers most sensitive to global competition. Local unresolved disputes took on a new life after the student struggles had shown the way. The strike then spread to railway, communications, public services, and within a week, insurance companies. Thank God. We had to shut down the insurance companies. No positive good there. My father worked in insurance. Banks began to close. Large shops were on strike, whether the workers were unionized or not. Right? We saw that in West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma. We see whiffs of that, right? That kind of idea. Dissident architects, occupied professional associations, government planners wrote a manifesto against using their skills in the interest of profit. Junior doctors and graduate students basically came out against the harsh hierarchical systems that were in their institution. The arts and even sports were transformed. Filmmakers refused to compete at cons. They said, that's capitalist, fuck. We're not gonna compete, fuck your cons. Damn with your competition. The bourgeois theaters were occupied, the most famous of which was Odeon, were occupied for meetings and amateur performances. Soccer players even occupied the football league, the federation, with their own demands, and on and on and on. When TV journalists finally and the production staff walked off their sets, because of the government censorship of what was actually happening in the streets, it was absolutely clear that the entire system was being called into question. Even farmers, not known as a bastion of radicalism, even farmers were collaborating in some sectors with the workers to discuss how to bring down, have price controls so that people can afford the food and cut out the middleman. I think it's key to remember that a general strike is not like a protest, or even like an open-ended kind of like an Occupy. Because the people who actually make society work have just shut it down. And yet society still has to function, including for the people who have to shut it down. Decisions about making sure that hospitals that provide life-saving services continue to get their electricity, but perhaps the folks living along Champs-Élysées not so much. Or workers have, all of these kinds of decisions are brought into question. And that's why in Russia, when in 1917, workers and soldiers and peasants there formed Soviets, workers' councils, to run things and make democratic decisions. And so faced with the day-to-day practicalities of running a general strike, and given the undemocratic nature of the dominant party, the French Communist Party, and its largest union, the CGT, workers in places where the bureaucracy was strongest actually didn't set up strike committees. Instead, workers and students, and in some cases workplaces and neighborhoods, set up action committees. And in Paris alone, there were some 450 of these action committees, and every city had dozens and dozens of them. And people would form them in a very informal way to basically take up, what are the slogans? What are the tracks? What is the next step? How do we get food here? How do we transport people who have a disability or whatever it is? They would coordinate these kinds of things. But they weren't elected. They weren't accountable. They weren't, if anybody took place in the General Assemblies at Occupy, you'd have some dynamic discussion one night, and the next night, perhaps you'd have to re-debate the same thing all over again. So imagine that on a metastasized scale nationally in the midst of a general strike, and you get some glimpse of what that must have felt like, both the energy of it and the electricity of it, but also the limitations of that kind of form of organizing. Now, pitch battles with the CRS had continued to take place throughout this time. Workplaces and neighborhoods became battlegrounds, became these sort of contested territories. And less than 2 weeks into the strike, the French state was in deep trouble. We always speak of workers' strike power. But so long as we live under capitalism, the ruling class also has a kind of a strike weapon of its own. And it can take its capital out of the country, which was literally happening by the suitcase. Banks throughout the world refused to deal in French francs. Its value was uncertain. The Prime Minister Pompidou wrote in his memoirs that he believed actually that the regime was very likely to be overthrown along with the French Republic. Whether that was actually accurate or not, that was the perception that many people had. President de Gaulle, in the early weeks, was virtually absent from the scene. He was even out of the country for part of the time. He operated like generals operated, like a Trumpist operates. You give an order, you expect your people to take out the orders, and that's it, move on. Next thing, right? But the workers weren't taking orders. Instead, they were marching by the tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands, chanting, adieu, adieu de Gaulle, goodbye, 10 years is enough, go. That was what the sentiment was. De Gaulle was ready to cut a deal. So he came to the trade union officials, who were all too happy to cut a deal with the French state. Even in the midst of this dynamic and powerful and potent weapon of the strike, they were ready to sit down for 25 hours of negotiations and hammered out something known as the Grenelle Agreement, which under ordinary circumstances would have been an extraordinary result. 35% raise in the minimum wage, 7-10% raise for the trade union wage, lowering of the number of hours that you had to work during the course of any week, and on and on and on. Once the trade union leader, essentially the CGT leader, Georges Seguy, comes out to a mass gathering of the workers, of 15,000, to present this agreement, he's shouted down, fuck you, betrayer, no way. Never do that again, don't speak in front of 15,000 people again, I'm gonna have to do stuff behind their backs. But that is what happened, it was done. Even that kind of agreement, people had tasted a bit of power, they wanted more than a raise, they wanted an end to repressive work conditions. You're talking about car plants where North African workers would be lined up alongside each other on the, you know, along the plant, and they'd never put people who could speak the same language next to each other so there could be no collaboration. Those people is a reason why the car plant stayed out longer than some of the others in June. The bitterness, the resentment that people had, the horror show that they felt about the conditions inside of their workplaces was not going to be resolved with a 10% raise or even for many a 35% raise. Extraordinary, but that's where people's consciousness was at. By the last week of May, police were in fact demoralized from the popular press and being hung out to dry by the regime, though hardly sympathetic to the strikers and the students. And the first whiff of military troop rebellion was taking place among some of the troops in Strasbourg, who issued a statement saying they want us to, they're amassing us to come out against you. We will not shoot on workers, we will fraternize. That was a dangerous statement. You have that combined with the fact that the French franc was becoming valueless. The French president basically de Gaulle leaves the country for several hours. For about 24 hours, he leaves the country, goes over the border to Baden-Baden in Germany, and actually consults with his generals there to see if he had loyal troops that could be brought in from Germany, and is actually considering just stepping down and resigning. And his generals tell him, you know, get a backbone. What are you, a wuss? Buck up, get back out there and fight these people. And that's what he did. I want to take a detour a little bit and talk a little bit about what role the organized forces played. Because the hundreds of action committees that involved many thousands of people were very quick on their feet. They were very nimble. But like I said before, decisions taken one day were not necessarily either accountable or carry outable or agreed upon the very next day. And you had, you know, in many ways, some of the strike committees, the very lowest participation was among regular, ordinary rank and file workers. The highest participation was among cadre of many of the social democratic parties and the communist parties, who had basically had nothing more profound to say than we need to win the next election and we need to have an electoral front. The cadre of the French Communist Party played an absolutely, a crushing role. What they sought was electoral power. But a general strike, as our friend Daniel Singer points it, is not an electoral gadget. And that's precisely how the major forces of the radical left perceived it. When de Gaulle took to the airwaves in late May, he scrapped the referendum that workers had already made a dead issue. He put forward a referendum, and the workers said, nobody's going to even print the ballot. In fact, in Belgium, they wouldn't even print the ballot. They couldn't even find anybody to print the ballot for a referendum. So he was like, well, that's over. And basically called the unions bluff and called for an emergency election at the end of June. And said, go ahead, we're in a near civil war situation here. I need your vote of confidence, French people. And this was really a turning point against the workers that put the wind in the sails of the right. The reformist leaders of the socialist and communist parties saw their powers tied to electoral gains. The political weight of the social democratic parties was far smaller than the French Communist Party, but nonetheless echoed those kinds of sentiments. Many of the small Trotskyist groups, who numbered no more than, 300 or 400 people, were too weak to have their message amplified in that morass. And on the evening when nearly a million French people poured into the streets to defend the Gaullist state against the sort of commie hordes, the government finally had the confidence to basically ban all of the small left groups, the Trotskyist organizations like ourselves, some of the anarchist formations and what have you. The French Communist Party was silent in response. By the end of June, there was an electoral catastrophe. The Gaullists increased their seats in parliament from 240 to 358. The French Communist Party fell from 73 to 34, and the Left Federation seats were halved. It was an absolute rout of the left. And we have to ask, and I'll bring it to a close on this, why? Workers' collective strength lies in the streets and workplaces, not at the ballot box. While it's absolutely true that the millions of students who are among the most militant and the most uncompromising in the struggle couldn't vote, the voting age was 21. Most of the students who took part in that struggle were at the head of it. They were 19, they were 20, they were 18, some of them 16. They couldn't vote. The 2-3 million immigrants in the country, they of course could not vote either. All of that is true. But nonetheless, the fact remains that the majority of the French working class, just weeks after having held power in the streets, either did not vote, voted for their old reliable social democratic parties, or people went with what they knew, the Gaullists. No large organized force was positioned to argue and win democratic strike committees and work and neighborhoods councils with elected and accountable leadership. You know, I think that in the absence of a revolutionary leadership, reformism can absolutely gain control even under those kind of extraordinary circumstances. And I like the way the French Trotskyist Daniel Ben Saïd, who died a few years ago, he was a participant and a leading member of the JCR, the Young Communist Revolutionaries, and has made tremendous contributions to our left tradition. He had this to say about the absence and the arguments coming from many of the most radical, uncompromising young rebels who also opposed parties and organizations. Looking at the Communist Party and the mess that was, they thought, well, if that is what a party is, we want nothing of it, and actually played a disorganized role in some regards. And the way he put it, he said, a politics without parties, whatever name, movement, organization, league, party that they are given, ends up in most cases with a politics without politics. Either an aimless tailism toward the spontaneity of social movements, or the worst form of elitist individualist vanguardism, or finally, a repression of the political in favor of the aesthetic and the ethical. I think that when we talk about the spontaneous explosion, because it was a spontaneous explosion, we also know that every spontaneous moment and movement contains rudimentary elements of conscious leadership, right? You look at Egypt in 2011, it didn't come out of nowhere. There had been 6 years of strikes and uprisings taking place on a localized level in Egypt. Even Occupy, we know of the small, you know, efforts, and even in New York City where it started, there had been an occupation, if you will, outside City Hall for weeks prior to that. In West Virginia, you know, the explosion, yes, there were handfuls of Reds in there, and many of the West Virginia teachers had spent some time in their youth walking a picket line with their parents. That has a profound impact on people and feeds into the spontaneity. It informs decisions that people make. Yet, nowhere in history has a spontaneous working class insurrection toppled the ruling class. It simply cannot be done. In France, 68, no party existed that actually would pose the question of power. Those who could, like the French Communist Party, wouldn't. And those who would, like the Trotskyists, absolutely could not, had no power to do it. I guess I want to end on saying what I think could have been done differently. It may not have been a pre-revolutionary situation, but it certainly was a situation in which more could have been won. Number one, there needed to be a call for a general strike. Nobody had ever called for a general strike. It was a strike that generalized, very different. There had been no combination of forces coming together to put forward demands and even conditions under which a strike would begin and end and be satisfied. And therefore, it depoliticizes by nature, by very definition, right? A call for a strike would have forced the development of a national platform and a centralized fight. I think a national strike committee could have been argued for and would have forced the question of political leadership rather than the strike petering out over weeks in June to much demoralization. And the question of centralization of a strike and the demands and a platform only leads to the question, who would lead? With what ideas? What politics? What demands? And in France, all of the major big parties kept it decentralized and fragmented, to everybody's loss and betrayal. I mean, basically, I feel like today the lessons are, you know, where there is no revolutionary party, there can be no revolution. There can be rebellion, there can be mass strikes, there can be massive upheavals, insurrection, but we will not see the culmination in anything like a road toward revolutionary power. Now, I have no idea what splits and shifts and reformations and mergers of groups and new forms of radical organizations are on the horizon. But I do believe that if we do not commence the building of a larger, bolder, revolutionary organization in the here and now, we will never live to see an actual revolution.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.